I'd like to turn to the 40th Psalm, or Mizmor, and continue to discuss Yahweh's position relative to his teaching, his Torah, his approach, his plan. It begins, and it says, "At that time I shared, behold, I am coming with the scroll of the written document which was dictated and scribed on my behalf regarding the work you have done and will do to accept me, God. I genuinely want and willingly accept this." And that's the difference between David, the author of this psalm, and the vast preponderance of people today. They aren't coming to God. They don't notice God. Henna, behold, means to stand up, to look up, to notice, to pay attention to God. Henna is the two letters that are repeated in Yahweh's names are both based upon the Hebrew word henna. The two hays are two people standing up, reaching up, looking up to God. And so here is Dode making an announcement. God's not bringing Dode to his home. Dode's coming. He's engaged. He's walking. He's coming. And Yah provided a path from our world to his. We need to take the initiative. We need to get about the journey. So Dode is not sitting there like a bumping along saying, "You know, I've got faith. I've got faith. I've got a good heart. I've got faith. You're going to save me." That's not what he's saying. He's saying, "I'm coming." And he's coming with something. And it sure as hell ain't the Christian New Testament. Sure as hell ain't the gospel of grace. Sure as hell ain't religion. What is he coming with? The written scroll of the Torah. And if you haven't integrated the written scroll of the Torah into your life, if you haven't focused on it, paid attention to it, come to understand what it said, responded to its invitations, then you're not coming to God. He knew that not only was that scroll scribed on his behalf, as it was scribed on my behalf, it was scribed on Glenn's behalf, it was scribed on Scott's behalf, it was scribed on the behalf of all of the covenant's children. But it also delineates the work that Yahweh has done and will do to accept us. It lays out God's role in his plan of salvation. And it's interesting that his plan of salvation is actually a byproduct of his overall plan for humankind, which is for us to engage in a family-oriented relationship with him. And then as a father strives to protect his children, in addition to nurturing his children and teaching his children and uplifting his children and empowering his children, our father seeks to protect us, to save us. But salvation is simply a byproduct of something that fathers do for their children. And Yahweh did this on our behalf, himself engaging to facilitate the Torah's ability to save us. And Dode is saying, "I free will, man." You know, he's not a Calvinist. Free will. "I've chosen and willingly accept the Torah." He says, "Your Torah," which means your instruction and teaching, your guidance and direction, "is within my midst, part of my inner nature." He incorporated it into his life, which is what provided him the proper perspective to gain understanding. It is what enabled him to respond, to come to Yahweh, to know what Yahweh has done and will do to accept us. It was only by examining the Torah sufficiently, observing it sufficiently, to not only know what it says, but understand what it says, that enabled Dode to make its perspective part of his life. He says, "I have proclaimed the good news," the basar. And folks, when Yosha speaks of preaching what is in English Bibles the gospel, he did not say gospel. He would never have used a pagan term. And he didn't. The Greek underlying that is eugelion, which means beneficial messenger, primarily, and healing message, secondarily. But he did not say euangelion, which is the Greek text that we have as a translation of what he said. He spoke Hebrew. His audience understood Hebrew. He said Bashar, that it is the Bashar that would be spread. The Bashar is the good news, and here it's the Bashar of vindication, of the Torah's ability to cause us to be righteous, upright, perfect in God's eyes, Shaddak. That's the message that he proclaimed. That's the message that his life represents. And Dod, like Yosha, did it in the great assembly of the esteemed community. Yosha came to Yehudim, to Yehuda, to Yisrael. And that's who Dod spoke to. Now, it is the responsibility of those Yehudim whom Yah has inspired to reach out to the rest of us. But we are second on this chain. Behold, my lips have not been restrained, Yahweh. And that's the thing that causes those of us who know who was part of the covenant to identify our brothers and sisters. There is something that all of the brothers and sisters of the covenant have in common, and that is that our lips are not restrained. That we share what Yahweh shared. That we tell all who are willing to listen what God had to say to us. If you are not engaged in sharing what Yahweh had to say, then you're not part of the covenant family. If you're not doing what Dod did, reading and then sharing the Torah, you are not engaged in a relationship with God. You have not been saved by God. You, unlike Dod, are not on your way to God. This continues. This is Psalm 40. Now we're at the 10th verse. You yourself know, you respect and acknowledge that I have not hidden nor concealed your means to achieve righteousness through vindication in the midst of my heart. This is important. It is something that is so different than religion. Almost all religions were called mystery religions for a purpose. There was always a mystery that only the initiate knew. This was extraordinarily common in the Greek philosophical and religious systems, particularly being indoctrinated into the mysteries of Dionysus. Paul constantly claims of the mysteries that are part of his doctrine. Mysteries are the basis of religious. You know, in Freemasonry, something we talked about earlier in this program, in Freemasonry, the initiate is gradually told more and more about the religious system of Freemasonry. And initially, they're only given symbols but not told what those symbols mean. And then later and later, as they go through the various hierarchy of the religion, the initiate is told everything about the mysteries. And so when you're dealing with hiding and concealing, like Mormonism, where, you know, you don't get to wear the special underwear and go into the inner sanctum and be given all of the great insides until you reach the various highest level. And the reason they do that is because once you come to know the truth, you recognize there's no way that makes any sense. If you were told that initially, you'd just say, oh, you guys are absolutely lunatics. But by the time you've invested your life in it, most people aren't willing to divest themselves of it. And at that point, they're in a position to benefit from the mythology. So it's been incumbent in religions throughout history to have mysteries of which only the initiates gradually learn the secrets over time. And Dota's saying, I got nothing to do with that. I haven't hidden anything. And that's the nature of engaging in a relationship with Yanuba. We share what we know when we know it. We don't hide anything. And sometimes that means we'll share things before we have complete and accurate knowledge. And we'll learn more and we'll go back and say, you know, I want to augment that. I want to share more information because I've learned more in this regard. But we never keep it to ourselves. We don't seek power through knowledge. We seek to empower others by knowledge. It's really, again, the antithesis of religion, where the pastor or priest or imam will claim a more powerful position because they claim to have more insights. And they lord over the others because of their knowledge. Yet in a relationship with Yahweh, as was being demonstrated here by Dode, whatever we come to know, we share. We want everyone to be equally empowered. In fact, I would tell you that when someone who has read one of the books where I've attempted to translate Yahweh's testimony and then help people understand what God is trying to say, when someone goes beyond, and it happens regularly, my level of understanding and really pushes the threshold way beyond what I saw in the passage and shares that with me or shares it with others, I'm thrilled. Absolutely thrilled. There is no desire to say, well, you know, I'm smarter than you. No, in fact, you want exactly the opposite. You want everyone to benefit from what God has to say. That's the attitude that Dode has. Now, Dode goes on to say, I have spoken about your trustworthiness and reliable nature and your salvation. This is emuna, which is trustworthiness, reliability, emuna, and your salvation. That word in Hebrew is Yeshua. Just as we would say the Son, the tangible representation of Yahweh, is Yahshua. Yahshua means salvation in Hebrew. So Dode, the man that Yahweh loves more than any who have ever lived, said, I have spoken about your trustworthiness and reliable nature and your salvation. Now this is a complete disaster for Pauline Christianity. If Yahweh's testimony is trustworthy, if it's reliable, and if he provides salvation, then everything Paul had to say is false. Then Paul's attack on the Torah is completely and wholly unjustified. Pauline doctrine is based on the notion that the Torah cannot save, and that his gospel of grace was designed to replace the Torah because, as I said, God could not be trusted. God was mean. He was enslaving. He was a tough disciplinarian. And that no one who trusted his Torah could be saved. And yet, Dode here is speaking specifically of the Torah. And he says that Yah was not only trustworthy, but that he provides salvation. Now, under that basis, how does one cling to the myth that Christianity has replaced the Torah? Hello, Kirk.
Good morning.
Yeah, how do you make that that dog hunt, as they say?
Yeah, that's you can't. I mean, the only credible source is Yahweh. The only credible source of writings are the Torah. And if they're wrong, then certainly Paul's wrong.
So I've got this really strange question. It's always perplexed me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Christians very seldom read anything other than their New Testament. Their Bibles all come with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms attached. In fact, 80% of the bulk of their Bibles include the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Are they not aware that Paul's letters, which comprise half of their New Testament, are in complete and utter conflict with the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms?
Well, they are. They just have to realize, or the preacher will say something to the effect that, you know, this is the New Deal. And why we need a New Deal, I don't know. But obviously, if you're trying to get away from a Yehudim, then you have to come up with a New Deal. You can't stay there and have a New Deal at the same time.
So they claim that they have a New Deal. Then why even consider the Old Deal?
That's the best question you put in your book. I mean, that's hit me real hard. I said, well, then why bother?
Yeah. I mean, why would you even bother with an old deal if the old deal was ineffective and you needed a new deal?
Well, go even further. In the New Testament, so-called, they're always arguing about what Paul said versus James, which of course was Jacob or Peter.
Right.
Shimon Kefish, and you say, well, why, if Paul's right, why the heck do you even care? Why do you keep the book of James in there? Why do you keep the book of, why do you
First and Second Peter in there? Right. And why bother with what Yosha says if Christianity is based upon what Paul wrote?
Yeah. Well, the most striking thing that came to me the more I studied was that, and I did ask this question as a Christian. I said, here's the Bible and everything's got the red print and there's nothing that Paul wrote that has any red print. So obviously he didn't quote him at all.
No.
Why?
Why? He claims he represents him, claims he met with him, and yet he never quotes him, never even mentions anything that he said and did.
Mm-hmm.
How is that even remotely possible?
It's totally impossible.
You know, this morning I was reading Luke, and it is so obvious that Luke is hearsay. When you read Matthew, Matanyah, and then you read Luke, and you just go and say, "Oh my God, did he get this stuff wrong?" I mean, the Sermon on the Mount is hugely truncated, it's misquoted, and it's on this level plane that he's delivering this, and it eliminates all references to the Torah. I mean, you just look at it, almost everything in Luke is, you know, he's talking about the historical characters that were around at the time, and you realize Luke not only wasn't there, not only didn't Luke hear any one of these conversations, he's not a witness to anything that he's reporting on, he didn't even have access to anybody who was a witness. I mean, he's not even quoting eyewitnesses. He is writing this decades after the fact, talking to people who talk to people who may have known someone who might have thought they heard. And you just read it and you go, oh my goodness, this is just awful. We'll be back with Kirk in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation here with Kirk on the mystery as to how anyone in their right mind could believe that Paul was speaking for God. One of the things, Kirk, that just strikes me is that as you read the eyewitness account of Matanyah, and then even read the hearsay account described by Mark, both make it absolutely clear that Yosha, in his final instructions to his disciples, and therefore to us, said that if anyone claims to have seen him prior to the entire world seeing him at one moment, one instant, that they're lying. Do not believe them.
What he said.
That's what Paul's basis of Pauline Christianity. So to accept Paul, you have to say that Yosha lied.
Yeah.
You know, Yosha and Matanyah, as he's just giving his most important public declaration, talks about don't ever think for a moment that I came to annul the Torah, and the basis of Paul's letters is annulling the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so if one told the truth, the other's lying.
Yes, sir. It's very cut and dry.
Very cut and dry. I mean, this is not complicated stuff, is it?
No, and you, if you honestly confront that, if you're a Christian as I was, and you honestly confront that, you have nowhere to go. You either got to walk away from Yahweh,
yes,
or you've got to stay with the Christian,
right,
or you
right.
have to realize that Christianity is not what God said. So throw all those books away and
right.
follow your own path.
Right. It's the only way to continue to embrace Christianity and its New Testament. Once you come to know about this irresolvable conflict, is to openly acquiesce to trusting and believing a lie. You have to knowingly believe a lie. Is it? There's no other choice. Are you willing to cling to the lie? And for you and me, that I know, Christianity was important to me. I was raised a Christian. I was married in a church. I was an ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, one of the oldest, youngest ordained ministers ever. Taught evangelism. I mean, Christianity was important to me, and yet I recognized that the only way that I could continue to be a Christian was to be wholly and completely opposed to God. I'd have to be estranged from Him. I couldn't be saved by Him. I couldn't engage in a relationship with Him. I couldn't be honest with Him. And I had to negate everything He had to say. It wasn't worth it to me, no matter how much I liked Christianity. And now I despise it, by the way. But at the time, it wasn't worth it to me. Did you go through a similar process?
I was a little. I probably would have if I had read your first book earlier. It would have been harder, but after the preacher had died, and then we started, I went to my grandfather was an elder in the Presbyterian Church, and I inherited all of his old books, which go back, some of them, a couple hundred years. So I started reading, because I obviously was missing something, because after 20 years of really studying Christianity, I must have felt that I couldn't figure out what I wanted to know.
Right.
So I started reading and reading and reading and reading, and then we started listening, and then my wife ran across you, and then you know the story from there. I threw the book down in the thing and said, I'm in real trouble now. And I basically came to that conclusion right on the spot. If this is right, everything else that I held true is wrong.
Yeah. My catharsis moment was once I was forced to translate out of Hebrew the passage in 2 Samuel 7, where it in all English Bibles says, when he sins, I will not spare the rod. And it was predicting the work of the Messiah, Yahusha. And I recognized, and I had to deal with that because I was writing a book on Islam, trying to deal with the prophecies. And I was saying, if this is true, then my entire basis of the Christian faith is wrong, because that would mean that the Messiah himself sinned, and therefore he suffered for himself, not for me. And I realized then that the word Asher was there, and Asher is a relational concept. And so when sin is associated with him, Yah says, I will not spare the consequence or the rod, the punishment.
But
then it makes perfect sense. But then I realize, wait a minute, if that's mistranslated, it's mistranslated, and I must have had like 12 different translations at the time. It's mistranslated in all 12 of them.
Yeah.
Then this is not the inerrant word of God. And now what does that mean?
Yeah.
And that was the beginning for me. And the next thing was then when I began to translate the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms and realized how completely opposite it was of my Christian religion. And then I began to compile the differences, and I went to probably the single most respected Protestant preacher in the world at the time, Jerry Falwell, who was my good friend. And I said, you know, Jerry, I can't reconcile these things. What God says, whose name is Yahweh, and the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and what you're promoting and Pauline Christianity, they're opposites. And I went through it point by point, and that was the ultimate wake-up for me when I pointed out to him that everything that he was promoting, from the Trinity to Paul's letters to Jesus Christ to Sunday worship to Christmas and Easter celebration, that it was all phony baloney. And he said, yeah, you're right, it is. It's all wrong. I know it's wrong. But I'm going to continue to promote it because that's what people come to my church to hear. And if I didn't promote it, they wouldn't come and wouldn't sit and fill these pews. And the envelopes that arrive with checks in them support my university would fail to arrive. And if you were to promote this, even though it's true, they'll label you a kook.
Did he not believe that Yahushua was real?
No, but his view was it was Jesus Christ. The real name was irrelevant.
No. If I'm talking to you,
yes,
and I point out that this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, and you agree that this and this and this is wrong,
right?
Then on what basis can you believe that this Jesus is right?
Oh, the Christian Jesus, he knows that
he knows because he knows
there's no basis. Yeah, there's no basis. You know, he knows there's absolutely no basis for, he knew, he's dead now, but he knew there was absolutely no basis for Christianity, for salvation by faith, for a gospel, for Jesus, for Christ, for Lord, for Christmas, for Easter, for any of it. I mean, he knew that it was all a pile of lies. But he was the most famous promoter of that pile of lies, and he was a hell of a nice guy, but it really wasn't. You know, when you realize, when somebody points out that everything you've said is untrue, and you're unwilling to respond because you're part of the religion,
you can't get out of it.
You can't get out of it, and that's why religion is so difficult for people. That we can share this psalm, for example, the 40th psalm, which provides the answer. It provides, tells us how we come to know who Yahweh is and receive his salvation, as well as how we enter his company, which is by observing the Torah. And it provides the answer. But if you're providing that answer, Kirk, in front of people who are enveloped in religion, does it? It doesn't resonate, does it?
Well, not in my experience. In fact, it's terribly frustrating and terribly sad. I mean, it's just, if you have to do it a few times to realize, my gosh, what does it take to get through to you people?
Right, like when you have a 12-page document that you present in front of Jerry Falwell, the foremost speaker certainly in America, mm-hmm, on Christianity, and he says, I'm not going to refute anything you've said. Everything you've said is true. And yet he'll continue to leave that meeting and be a Christian preacher. You just have to shake your head and say, there's no way to get through to them. You can't fix this.
I wanted to ask you, while we're talking, sure, about Yahushua, yesterday, of course, I was working, so I listened on mm-hmm, with Terry. She listened live, and I listened afterwards. Mm-hmm. And she asked me the question, when you said Yahushua is ordinary,
yeah,
which I understand, he asked a Ken with us, and he was, mm-hmm, ordinary, and he, mm-hmm, and he wasn't recognizable or extraordinarily good-looking or tall.
Right.
Or,
yeah, whatever, ordinary.
I mean,
right,
he may have
ordinary,
been taller, stronger.
Yeah, I think he probably was taller than the average Yehudim at the time, but he was, otherwise, he was indistinguishable. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we know he's man. He's,
right.
We know he's ordinary, and we know,
yeah,
that his
body was typical human body, and no different than any other typical human body. It's going to get calluses and sores and aches and pains and hunger and thirst, just like every other ordinary body. And it was born, came out of a woman's womb, mm-hmm, as an ordinary child.
But a couple of things that do distinguish him from us ordinary people, he's got,
yes,
to have the best DNA in town.
Yeah, I would agree that he's got more extraordinary DNA, but that would not be distinguishable.
No, but I mean, but in that regard, if that guy Roll or whatever did a blood test on the from the
Yeah, it's really, and I wouldn't give it, because even his closest associate disavows it. We're talking about Ron Wyatt being able to take some of the blood from the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant that that Yahusha during the crucifixion dripped down on as the earth opened from that earthquake and dripped down on the mercy seat. Now, I absolutely think that the blood of the Passover lamb did, in fact, drip down on the mercy seat, and that it is exactly where Ron Wyatt said it was. The testing of it is something that, you know, I'm not... There's no proof of it. What the interesting thing is, and the point I was making is that he, in terms of the child being born unto us and a son being given to us, and you read Gabriel's announcement of how Elizabeth was to come to bear Yahochanan, and then how Mary would come to bear Yahusha. The presentation is identical, and they are compared directly to one another, and they both talk about the proximity of and the influence of the set apart spirit in the womb, but both describe childbirth in a very natural way, just like Yahweh described it with Abraham and Sarah. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk, we're talking about the nature, the physical nature of Yahusha. And I'm open to your views on this, from my perspective, I find that his physical nature and how his physical nature came to be totally and completely irrelevant. It literally means nothing to me. I look at the physical body is serving strictly as a means of locomotion, a means of being able to talk and to teach people, and then serving as the Passover lamb, and that it was thereafter destroyed, and that one of the great crimes of Christianity is to turn this physical body of a man into a god. And so it really means nothing to me. But what I was hinting at is that the actual conception, the way that the testimony is referring to Joseph and equating what happened not only with Elizabeth and Yahochanan, but also with the same kind of story of Sarah and Abraham, that there's not a lot of miracle there, and doesn't need to be.
And I'm on the same page with you on that. I was just some interesting parts about it, like, you know, at 12 years old, he knows more about the Torah than I'll know till I get the Torah in me.
So, that's correct.
This is an extraordinarily little guy.
And
what point the child is given, or the child is born, and the son is given? Is there a point when we're told that,
and I don't know if it's true because it's in the.
Well, these are just fun questions.
Yeah, I know. So it's in the wrong set of text to know for certain. But we're told that with Yahochanan, the immerser, that the spirit, the set apart spirit, came upon him in the womb. We're even told with Yirmiyah that Yahweh knew him in the womb, which means the set apart spirit would have been part of him in the womb. So certainly Yahweh can do that. Most of us choose to bring the set apart spirit on us based upon our response to Yahweh. My sense is that the soul, which is the consciousness of Yahusha, is literally Yahweh's soul. I think Yahweh has a soul for the express purpose of Yahusha. So I think the set apart spirit was more universally, more completely, more empowered with Yahusha than it was with anyone else by a magnitude even beyond my comprehension. When he was speaking as Yahweh.
Yeah. The Christians might notice, I used to bug them with this, and when I was one, even, that, Yohanan was mm-hmm. born, the immerser was born in the spring, and 6 months later it says Yahusha was born. Mm-hmm. So that puts it in the fall. They don't put it at December 25.
No, it certainly doesn't. No, it's as a matter of fact, you can actually, you can go through the timing of the information that's provided to us in Luke, and come to the conclusion that Yahusha was would have been born to the extent that the son was the child was came unto us. At Sukkah, which would have been in early October of probably 2 BCE. But the challenge, I think it's obvious that he was conceived on Sukkah, because Sukkah represents God camping out with us, and God's just too much of a perfectionist to let something like that.
Yeah,
he's just not going to let an opportunity like that get by. But does he claim it? No. One of the reasons, although it's, in Yohanan, he tabernacled with us. The Sukkah and tabernacles are one and the same. One of the things when you read all of the eyewitness accounts is that Yahusha spoke in parables, and he spoke around things. He never once, with exception of his statements on the Torah, everything else he had to say, he spoke around things. He is, and specifically said, I'm going to speak in parables. I'll explain the parables to the disciples. But he says, I want for public consumption the parable that speaks around issues. And that's very much like Yahweh's approach, which is he does never just lay it out and say, here's the five terms and conditions of the covenant. Here's the seven-step path to me. Yahusha isn't that deliberate either. And the reason is, he wants you to figure it out. And if you're not willing to invest the time to figure it out, he doesn't want to spend eternity with you. Bottom line to the whole thing. Kirk, enjoyed talking with you. I hope you call back again soon.